Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for an hour each weekday afternoon. We take your phone calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, we talk to you about those subjects. If you have a different viewpoint from the host and want to call about that, we'll talk to you about that as well. Right now our lines are full, but I will give you a number which you can call when they are no longer full. And all that takes is for me to have a conversation with somebody who's currently on the line. And when they move along, a line opens and you can get right in if you call right away. So have this number ready. The number is 844-484-5737. Again, that's 844-484-5737. And our first caller today is Michael from Live Oak, California. Michael, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Good to hear you as always.
Yeah.
So, at your last meeting, there was someone that I who recognized me from being on the radio, and every once in a while it happens where I'm just touched by someone's presence, and you know, it's very powerful. And of course, we're all. I think everyone is seeking love and connection, and is wanting to feel that they have a place in the universe. And not everybody finds that in the ordinary world.
Right, but now let me ask you this: do you find that in Buddhism?
What do I find?
Do you find that it gives you a significant place in the world and so forth?
No, the aim of that path is to find the transcendent peace. It's not...
Okay, so it doesn't necessarily produce what it is that you say we're all looking for.
No. Where I was going was... And this is my sense, but I don't know for sure. My sense that if one has received Christ's Spirit, then that should be sufficient. And would be more in the form of a question: would that be sufficient? And one would not need a relationship and all of that. How is that understood? That's the first.
Now, when you say one would not need relationship, you mean with people or with God?
No. Having God, that would be sufficient, and one would not hanker after the things of the world, including relationship. Is that how it's understood, or?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, the Bible indicates that God made us for relationships, not just with Himself, but with each other, and that's why there's two commands. One is that you should love God with all your heart, soul, and mind and strength. And then there's the command that you should love your neighbor as you love yourself. And actually, though Jesus said all the law and the prophets boil down to these two commands, the vast majority of the commands in the Old Testament are for the second. They have to do with how a person conducts a loving relationship, mutually so, hopefully, with other people. And so the Bible would not assume that we are people who do not need love from other people, generally speaking. Now, of course, there's many things that we may generally need that we can live without if necessary. So there are many people who live without a lot of love. But I don't think anyone lives without any connection with other people. I guess maybe there could be a hermit in a cave somewhere who just eats the moss that grows on the side of the cave and licks the condensation off the walls and survives that way. But I really don't know that there are people like that. And if there are, they're very abnormal. The normal situation that Christianity envisages is one where there's a community of people who love God and who love each other. And this is the way that at least the psychic and spiritual needs of people are intended to be met. We don't do it merely to meet our needs, though. Having our needs met is a byproduct of doing what is right, what we were made to do. Having our needs met comes in the package, but it doesn't mean that we go into a relationship with God because we are just seeking to have our needs met. We go into a relationship with God because he deserves it. He deserves our loyalty. He deserves our love. And we love other people because he puts his love for them in our hearts and commands us to love them. So we that's why we do those things. But having needs met that we have to be loved come as a result of that.
Are you still there?
Yeah.
Oh, I heard a beep. Well, anyway, I'm not much of a poet, but this poem came to me. It's very brief, if I could share it. I think it communicates just what you were saying, that sense of the appreciation of others and that longing. Is that okay if I just read this very brief poem?
Well, if it doesn't take very long, go ahead.
All right. And this was in response to this person that I met at your meeting. Flame in my heart, Christ-infused flower of boundless benevolence, heart aching for the lost and trembling. Brave warrior of the heart, unafraid to share the Lord's love with those holding weird views, and even so kind as to reach out to a crimson-stained Jewish Buddhist who would gladly be crucified to be allowed into the kingdom of light so visible through the portals of your eyes. No sacrifice apart from my entire wretched self would suffice. Darkness and light cannot hang out together. Cherish adoration, devotion, awe, words which are only a pale reflection of the passion of my heart's submission to the sanctity of your Father's authority. That just came to me.
All right. Well, Michael, while we don't want everybody calling up and reading their poetry here, you're such a regular caller and known to our listeners, we make a concession this time. But I'm glad that you felt welcomed and loved and touched, as you've many times you've said that that is the case when you've come to the Christian meeting. So I hope someday that you'll love Jesus like Christians are called to do, and that you'll be a Christian yourself. But it is true that you are recognizing something in the Christians that you're probably not finding elsewhere. I appreciate your call. Let's talk next to Everett from San Pablo, California. Everett, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, my delight. Thank you so much, Steve. Two questions. Question number one is about St. John chapter 8, about the woman caught in adultery. And according to some, I would guess, theologians or scholars would ever say that that was an insertion, that that was not actually something in the original ancient manuscripts of Dead Sea Scrolls or whatever. Can you comment on that for us?
Well, actually, what it is John chapter 7, verse 52, through the opening, verse 53, through the opening verses of chapter 8, up to about verse 12, I think it was up through verse 12, if I'm not mistaken. That section is not found in some of the oldest manuscripts. And there are other things in our Bibles that are not found in some of the oldest manuscripts, but they are found in other manuscripts. So there's some dispute. There's a general feeling among most scholars that if it's not in the oldest manuscripts, but it's in some other manuscripts, that it must not have been in the original, and it was added by somebody else at some later date. Now, even those who feel that way about this passage, most commentators I've read, have suggested that this particular story, this famous story of the woman taken in adultery, that it was not originally part of the Gospel of John, but that it may have been part of another gospel, and in the process of time, somebody copied it over into John, and it became part of our story in John's Gospel. Most commentators that I have read do not want to give up this story as a genuine story. But they have questions as to whether it was originally found in this particular spot in the Gospel of John. There are a few manuscripts where the same story, the same passage, is found in Luke's Gospel. Now, it doesn't appear in Luke's Gospel in the majority of manuscripts, nor in the oldest, but there are some manuscripts that do contain this story in Luke's Gospel near the end in the Passion Week. And some have suggested that would actually be a more proper setting for it. And it's interesting, too, because in this particular passage, it says that the scribes and Pharisees came to Jesus. Now, that expression, scribes and Pharisees, is not found anywhere else in the Gospel of John. John doesn't use that expression. But it's used a lot in Luke and in Matthew and in Mark, and it, especially in those Gospels in the Passion Week before Jesus was crucified. There were quite a few times when the scribes and Pharisees came to Jesus with testing questions, trying to find fault with him. And we read about those in Matthew and Mark and in Luke, but not in John. But this story resembles those. Here the scribes and the Pharisees come to Jesus, and they're trying to test him. Now, this could have been at some other time than in the Passion Week, because I'm sure he was tested more times than once in his life. But it's also the case that it may be that the manuscripts that contain it in Luke have it in its original position, though not many scholars are necessarily willing to suggest this. There's a lot of different theories about it, but the truth is that some of the important manuscripts do not include it in John.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you very much for that answer. The other question, number two, is Seventh-day Adventism. They put a lot of emphasis on the seventh day. I haven't done the research yet, but where does the word, why do they call themselves Seventh-day Adventists, and why is there so much emphasis put on the Sabbath day?
Well, Ellen G. White, the founder of that movement, or the leader of it, placed a lot of emphasis on the seventh day, and I'll tell you the reason why. But if you're wondering about the word Adventists, in the 19th century, there were some movements in Protestantism that really emphasized the imminent coming of Jesus. One of those movements was the Millerite movement, where a man named William Miller actually predicted an actual date in the 1840s when Jesus would return, and his followers went up on a mountain and waited for it, and it didn't happen. And that was called the Great Disappointment. And out of his movement, there were still some who believed a lot of the things that Miller had taught were good, and still the emphasis on the second coming of Christ. See, Advent, this is referring to the second Advent, the second coming of Christ. We maybe know the word Advent from the Advent calendars from the first coming of Christ, the first Advent. The word Advent means coming. And so Adventists are emphasizing the second coming, the second Advent of Christ. But the Seventh-day Adventists are particularly emphasizing the need to keep the Sabbath day. Now, why did Ellen G. White emphasize this? Well, she believed when she read in the New Testament that believers are to keep the commandments of God, that this meant the Ten Commandments. Now, you'll find Adventists will do this all the time. You find in, for example, Revelation chapter 12, at the end of the chapter, it talks about how the beast or the dragon persecuted the woman and the remnant of her seed, those who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus. Now, you see, they would say, well, those who have the commandments of God must be those who are keeping the Ten Commandments. And this comes from, I guess, just not being very biblically literate and thinking that when the Bible says commandments, it means the Ten Commandments. They don't seem to realize that there are hundreds of laws in the Bible that are called the commandments of God. But for some reason, they want it just to be the Ten Commandments. So when they read of the commandments of God, they think it's the Ten Commandments. Now, of course, if you read the Ten Commandments, you find one of them, the fourth commandment, says, you shall remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Do all your work in 6 days, and on the seventh day, you don't do any work. And so that's the seventh day. That's Saturday, of course, each week, was the Sabbath. Now, because the New Testament talks about Christians as those who keep the commandments of God, Ellen G. White believed that those commandments are the Ten Commandments. And that means we have to keep the fourth commandment as well as the others. And therefore, we need to keep the Sabbath. And so this became sort of a distinctive of their movement. Now, other Christians in that time also believed that we have to keep the Sabbath day and the Ten Commandments, but they believed that the Sabbath had changed to Sunday. This is perhaps the view of some Christians still today. It certainly is not a biblical idea. The Sabbath never has been Sunday. Neither in the Old Testament nor in the New Testament is the Sabbath ever a reference to Sunday. every time the Sabbath is mentioned, it's always referring to the seventh day Sabbath, the Jewish Sabbath. But there was a tradition that entered the church somewhere back there that said that the Sunday was the Sabbath. So there was a, in the Protestant churches, many, most Christians were celebrating, or if we say celebrating, or just observing Sunday, the first day of the week, as the Sabbath. Well, Ellen G. White's emphasis was, well, the Sabbath never was the first day of the week. And she was right about that. And that this, it's the seventh day. And so her movement was called the Seventh Day Adventists. They were emphasizing the advent of Christ, the second coming, and the need to keep Sabbath on the seventh day. Now, I believe that the traditional Christians who believe that Sunday is the Sabbath were wrong. I believe that Ellen G. White was right in recognizing Saturday as the Sabbath. It is. But I think she was mistaken in thinking that the Sabbath is a command for the New Testament. The Sabbath is not a New Testament command. You never find a New Testament writer suggesting that keeping the Sabbath is a New Testament obligation. And the mistake comes from just assuming, without any New Testament support at all, that the Ten Commandments are the rule of life for Christians. Now, if the Ten Commandments are the rule of life for Christians, then the fourth commandment would have to be included. And that command is that on the seventh day we rest. That's a Jewish observance. That's part of the Old Covenant. It's part of the Jewish religion. It's not part of the Christian religion, at least if we define Christian as the things that Jesus taught and the things that the New Testament teaches. There's no obligation mentioned in the New Testament to keep a Sabbath day. And Jesus and Paul actually spoke about such things in such a way as to suggest that Sabbath keeping was no longer really to be an issue. Jesus said it's lawful to do good on the Sabbath. Well, of course, we're supposed to do good every day. So the Sabbath is like any other day. He said the Son of Man is the Lord even of the Sabbath day, which means that he's the Lord of every day, including the Sabbath. So that what we do is obey Jesus. He's the Lord. That means we obey him. And we obey him every day, including the Sabbath day. There's no difference between one day and another. We obey Christ every day. So Jesus did not seem to enforce a distinction between the Sabbath and other days. He included the Sabbath with all other days. So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath day. Meaning, of course, he's the Lord of the other days, but he's even the Lord of the Sabbath too. So that instead of observing Moses' instructions about the Sabbath, we have to observe Christ's instructions every day, including the Sabbath day. Paul, of course, made the statements very clear, too. He said that there were some Roman Christians who did observe a certain day of the week and others did not. In Romans chapter 14, verse 5, he says, one man esteems one day above another. Another man esteems every day alike. And he just said, well, let everyone be fully persuaded in his own mind. Obviously, there's no obligation to go either way, or else he would have told them which way to go. He just said, do whatever you want in your conscience, whatever your conscience tells you to do. Be fully persuaded in your own mind. Clearly, not placing an obligation on those to keep the Sabbath who were instead observing every day alike. Likewise, Paul said in Colossians 2, in verses 16 and 17, don't let anyone judge you about keeping festivals or new moons or Sabbath days. He said, those things are a shadow for the time being. The substance or the body, he said, is of Christ. So this is how the New Testament talks about Sabbath keeping. It's not required. It's not part of the Christian obligation. The Ten Commandments, therefore, are not the law of the Christian life. What is? Obeying Christ is the law of the Christian life. He's the Lord. Jesus said, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and you don't do what I say? So it's obvious that we need to obey Christ. But the Ten Commandments are not the rule book for the Christian. That those are belong to the Old Covenant. And so I think Ellen G. White was mistaken, and so was the rest of the church to a large extent, because they all thought we have to keep the Sabbath day. It's just that most Christians had made the mistake of thinking that Sunday is the Sabbath day, which it is not and never was. All right, let's talk to Don from Salem, Oregon next. Don, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
I was headed for the store the other day and turned on the car radio, and I was listening to a host, someone with a program, and she had a guest on who's written a book on how the last days are coming and they're rushing down upon us. And
well, that's not uncommon. Lots of people write books like that.
I was a bit confused. I accepted the Lord when I was 8. When I was 18, I was immersed. When I was 23, I went to Bible college. I've served a few pastorates. I've been married. I've raised 3 kids. And my son has gone to the Lord already, and so is my wife. And I kept listening for a bucket list. What must I do? The Lord is coming. What can I do now? And they weren't giving any bucket lists. They were more or less talking about the sky falling. So I'm calling you and letting you give us a bucket list since the Lord is coming. I'm going to hang up now.
Okay, Don, thanks for your call. Well, first of all, I don't have a bucket list. You know, if somebody told me, if an angel appeared from heaven and said, just a fair warning here, this weekend Jesus is coming back, I would pretty much do what I'm doing right now. There's not much I would do different. And that's because I believe we should always live every day the way we would if we knew Jesus was coming today. And although no doubt most people would be skeptical about the suggestion that Jesus is coming today, it is entirely possible that he could, but even beyond that, people should know it's not at all impossible that we could die today. I mean, today could be the last day of our earthly existence, and therefore we should be doing today and every day what we would wish to be found doing if Jesus came back or if we died and we were issued into his presence. So I would do the same thing I'm doing now, and I would suggest every Christian should be doing at every moment the very thing they hope they will be found doing if they would die today or if Jesus would come back today. Now, it's interesting, you do make an interesting point, and that is a lot of people who emphasize that the world is ending and write books about it and so forth, they don't necessarily tell you what to do about it, what to do differently. And no doubt it's because in many cases, they just want to sell a book to people who are interested in knowing what the future holds. They're not, emphasizing in some cases the obligation of discipleship or following Jesus moment by moment and day by day. And they're emphasizing rather the sensationalist theme that we're living in the end of the world. And actually, you'll sell a lot more books by making some kind of a convincing case that we're living in the end of the world than you will by telling people to live holy lives, to deny themselves and take up their cross and follow Jesus every day. Jesus said, deny yourself and take up your cross daily and follow me. That would be what I would emphasize. Even if I believed we're at the very end of the world, if I believed that Jesus was going to come back in my lifetime, which he could, but I don't have any conviction that he will, if I believed that, I still wouldn't write a book trying to tell people that he's coming back in our lifetime. I would instead prefer to urge people to do what Christians should always do, whether Jesus is coming back soon or not. And I would suggest, sometimes people say, well, but if you tell them, if you let them know Jesus is coming back soon, then they'll be motivated to do the right thing. Well, they won't be motivated in a godly way. If the godly way to be motivated is to realize God owns me. God made me. Jesus died for me. He purchased me. I belong to him. I'm not my own. I should live for him, whether he's coming or not. You see, a godly motivation is to serve God because he deserves it. But if I say, well, I wouldn't serve God, but oops, I think Jesus is coming back, I better make sure I'm kind of doing the right thing for the next few minutes so that when he comes by, he'll see me doing the right thing and he'll mistake me for a true Christian. You know, he'll think I'm really one of the good guys because I've all of a sudden started acting like I care about him. I've started to act like I care about being a Christian. I don't. I just don't want to miss the rapture. I don't really want to go to hell. But maybe God won't notice that. He'll think I'm sincere. Well, you know, if somebody loves God, they're going to love God whether they believe this is the end of the world or not. And if they do believe it's the end of the world, it's not going to make them love God anymore. it might make them want to fool God or manipulate God or hedge their bets or something like that. But that's not what gets people saved. People don't get saved by fooling God or trying to, you know, put on, you know, a temporary zeal for God until the danger has passed. No, God is looking for people who want him. And some people do, and some people don't. The ones who do, they'll be serving him with or without any concern about the end of the world. Everyone knows that we're living in our final generation because we're all going to die. And so anyone who has that much information, even knowing that we could die today, you know, if they have any inkling toward God, they will have made a move in that direction without any further information about the end of the world. But, you know, somebody who doesn't care about God, and that would be probably the majority of people you see day by day, telling them it's the end of the world doesn't make them care about God. It would just make them care about themselves more. And, you know, well, I don't want to, if I'm living at the end of the world, I want to make sure that I've got my my insurance payments up, you know, and I'm ready to, you know, I'll be doing the right thing when Jesus comes. Well, doing the right thing isn't what saves you. It's loving God and it's having a relationship with him. It's not legalistically doing Christian things. So a bucket list would actually be that kind of a thing, a legalistic list of things, Christian kinds of things I want to be found doing when he comes back. Well, if those are good things to be doing when he comes back, why wouldn't those be great things to be doing today and tomorrow and the next day and every day, whether he comes back or not? You see, if I'm doing what he wants because I believe that that is the right thing to do, you don't have to scare me into it by telling me it's the end of the world. And if I don't believe it's the right thing to do, and I do them anyway because I think it's the end of the world, then I'm just being a hypocrite. You see, the question is, how am I disposed toward God? Not how am I disposed toward saving my skin in the end of the world, but how am I disposed toward God himself? Am I willing to recognize that he's a wonderful, gracious God who's given me every blessing that I have? Maybe not as many as I would like. If I'm a selfish person, I might be more focused on the things he hasn't given me and be forgetting all the great things he has given me. That's why David said, "Bless the Lord, O my soul. Don't forget all his benefits," he said in Psalm 103. I think many people have forgotten all the benefits God's given them. And they only focus on their complaints, what he hasn't given them, what they wish he had done. Well, people like that are, one thing can be said about them, they're totally self-centered. And that means they're not in any condition of heart to be saved anyway. You can't be saved if you're self-centered. Jesus said, if you want to come after me, you have to deny yourself and take up your cross and follow me. Now, if anyone's smart enough to realize that God is smarter and better and more deserving of pleasure than we are, and that our role is his creation, is to give him pleasure and to glorify him, and to enjoy him forever, then people will do the right thing, and they don't have to be told it's the end of the world. Maybe it is, maybe it's not, but it wouldn't really matter. Never doesn't matter to me, because it could be the end of my world today. As I sit here right now, you know, a missile from North Korea could land in my living room, you know. So what does it matter to me if it's the end of the world? What matters to me is that I live my life in a different condition than I might otherwise, namely in a good relationship with God because I love him. That's what matters to me. That's what matters to Christians who have a biblical perspective on salvation. Let's talk to Jim from Sacramento, California. Jim, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call, Steve. I have a question about Acts 21:18, but I'd like to give a little bit of testimony. I hear what you're talking about as far as loving Jesus and walking in his will, those
okay.
kinds of things. And I just was on a little travel through Sacramento this morning, and I helped a young pastor start a church, just helped him briefly with some painting and carpeting and things like that about a year ago. And I was just happened to be driving through that area again, and I stopped in there, and I saw the beautiful setting. It was a storefront at the time, kind of run down. Well, there's 100 seats, chairs there now. I'm going to call him and talk to him a little about this. But the overwhelming presence of the Holy Spirit at that time to show that, you know, he is so pleased with this little church in a very poor neighborhood and rundown neighborhood in Sacramento. And to me, that's, you know, if you want to talk about nirvana or whatever, it's this love for God, the love for the people of God, and doing God's will that turns keeps me turned on, you know. And so I would suggest that Michael just let go of what he has and make a commitment to Christ and see what happens when you really make a commitment to follow God and walk in his presence, love him, and love his people. It's a experience that you really can't describe.
Yeah, well, Michael has been calling this show for about 10 years now, and we have listeners, you know, who are praying for him, and I've asked him many times, why doesn't he just abandon, you know, the Buddhism that, you know, that doesn't really have the answers and follow Christ? But there, I don't know, there's something, some bit of resistance in there that I'm not sure I understand. But anyway, I appreciate your sharing. What was your question?
Well, in Acts 21:18, Paul has come back to Jerusalem. He's carrying an offering there for the Jerusalem church. But 21:18 says that Paul went up with us to James, and all the elders were present. You know, I just kind of wondering what this church in Jerusalem looked like. If you skip down to down there a couple of verses, the Jews there are who have believed, and they are all zealous for the law. So, you know, there's this conflict there, but how many elders were there? You know, what did that church look like? Was it a group of house churches? Were they meeting somewhere? Do we have any information other than what is here in Acts?
No, we only have what's here in Acts, we have several different descriptions of the Jerusalem church in Acts, but they're at widely different times. Like the first seven chapters would describe the Jerusalem church at the very beginning, right after Pentecost, and it was a great church in revival. You know, when the Spirit came upon them, it was a tremendous, powerful movement. Later on in Acts 15, Paul and Barnabas go to the church in Jerusalem, and they have a conference where they decide whether the Gentiles have to keep the law or not, have to be circumcised. The church rules with Paul that they don't have to, that the law is not part of the obligation of Christians. And then now, this one is decades later, near the end of Paul's ministry, he's back in the church, and James is the leader of the church, and there's probably some of the other apostles there. We don't know much about where the other apostles were at this late date. They had been in Jerusalem in the earlier seasons, but they eventually, tradition tells us, they went out far and wide to evangelize the world. So we don't know how many of the apostles were still there. They had elders there, but then they had elders there earlier too. In Acts 15, for the Jerusalem Council, the apostles and the elders met to decide the circumcision question. Now this is many years later. There are elders still. It may be that if the apostles were now leaving Jerusalem, and maybe there weren't many of them left there in Jerusalem, that their duties as leaders of the church had been assumed by elders in Jerusalem, just as Paul had set up Gentile churches having elders overseeing them. We don't know, though. We only have these passing references, and nobody knows because we don't have any other early records. So we can't really paint a very thorough picture. But we can say this. The church seems to have been pretty locked in to the temple. And it's not too surprising in view of the fact that the temple was there in their town. And the temple was not just a big church. The temple was the center of the Jewish religion internationally. And Jews from all over the world made pilgrimages to that temple in Jerusalem. It was the center of their whole Jewish faith. Now, the Christians had become Christians, followers of Christ, and not technically part of the Jewish religion, which is an anti-Christian religion. It's clear the Sanhedrin, the leader of the Jewish religion, was persecuting Christians and persecuting Paul and so forth. But nonetheless, the Christians who lived there in the shadow of the Jewish temple, where Jewish pilgrimages, you know, ended, and, you know, the place was always packed with Jews worshiping the temple, the church in Jerusalem was made up of Jewish people who were Christians now. And so the easiest thing for them to blend in was to continue, you know, fitting in with the temple services. Now, whether they thought this was necessary as Christians or whether they thought this was just one way to not bring offense to the city, we do not know. We know that Paul himself said in 1 Corinthians 9 that when he was around those who kept the law, he would keep the law in order to win those who are under the law. Though when he was with Gentiles who didn't keep the law, he didn't keep the law because he was basically culturally sensitive. It may well be that the church in Jerusalem was still, you know, observing temple practices just in order to be culturally sensitive so they could reach Jews. Or it may be that they were still of a mind that the temple had relevance to Christianity. If they did, they were not very enlightened about this. Paul knew better, and they certainly learned later when the temple was destroyed and Christianity continued all the same that the temple really had nothing essential to do with the Christian faith. But there was that leaning, as you mentioned here, of the church in Jerusalem to be zealous for the law, meaning the sacrifices and the temple rites. We can see that because James knew of four men in the church who had kept a Nazirite vow. And he asked Paul if he would show his solidarity with the Jewish church by going with them to the temple and paying their Nazirite fees. And Paul did. So we can see that Paul, again, is accommodating out of Jewish sensitivity so he doesn't cause problems. And those Christians who lived in Jerusalem might have had to live with that accommodation all the time. And so we do see them, you know, still maintaining their Jewish practices, though they were Christians.
So you don't think that there was a underground house trying to church movement there because of the persecution?
You know, the persecution kind of came and went at different times, and it may well be that this was kind of underground, that their meetings were kind of underground, but we don't have any indicator of it in Acts that they went underground here. It may be that the persecution that had driven the Christians out of the city decades earlier had died down, and that the Jewish Sanhedrin was just kind of coexisting more or less peaceably with the Christians in town, since the Christians were, you know, keeping kosher standards and things like that. It's difficult to know because we aren't told that much.
Question about house churches. The early church, as Paul went out, was, you know, establishing house churches in the various towns where he went.
Yeah.
And I assume they were under his authority. And of course, there's always opportunities for, you know, there's house churches meeting here in Sacramento and different places. But the question is, coming under authority, you know, do a house church that sets up, do they need an overseer from a local church or some authority to make sure they're staying in the, you know, teaching correctly?
Well, not necessarily. Of course, if a group of Christians starts getting into weird doctrine, that's going to marginalize them from fellowship with the rest of the body of Christ, which eventually, if they accept that marginalization, they become cultic. But if we say, well, the solution to that is to make sure they have an apostolic leader in the church, well, where are you going to get one of those? I am aware that there is a house church movement which originated out of Jacksonville, Florida, which indicates that a true house church has to have an apostolic leader as its founder. And an apostolic leader means somebody from their movement. Now, the question I would have is, A, if a legitimate church has to have an apostolic founder to be a legitimate church, what does the apostolic founder have to legitimize his apostolic authority? You know, the fact that a movement in Jacksonville happens to believe that he's an apostolic founder doesn't make it so. And there are false apostles in the New Testament as well as real ones. So, if we were to say, well, every meeting in a home has to be overseen by an apostolic leader, well, you know, where are you going to find those? And if someone comes along and says, I'm an apostolic leader, I'll oversee your group. And I have seen this. I've seen this, apostolic so-called leaders come into an area, and there's a group of Christians who want to have a house church. And so this person says, okay, I'll oversee your group because I'm an apostolic leader. To me, that in many cases, the person who claimed to be an apostolic leader didn't have any more legitimacy to his claim to be an apostolic leader than anyone else in the church had. This is just, I don't know if you're part of a movement like that, or if the people in the movement you're in are saying things like that, but there's nothing in the Bible that suggests that a house church has to be started by an apostle. Now, it is true that the apostles were the main evangelists and missionaries in the early days of the church, so that most of the churches were founded by apostles, but not all of them. For example, the church in Rome was not started by an apostle, as far as we know. All the apostles of the 12 were still in Jerusalem after the church in Rome was founded. And no one knows how the church of Rome was founded, but it could have been spontaneously founded, just like the church of Antioch was spontaneously founded and some others. You see, like the church of Antioch was founded without an apostle. And the apostles in Jerusalem did send up their man Barnabas to check it out and make sure it was okay. And he said it was, but they didn't indicate that, you know, they had to have an apostle residing there to be a church. It's always nice. I mean, if there's a real apostle around, who wouldn't want him in your church? I would. But unfortunately, it's rather difficult to establish any living person today as having real apostolic authority. And I personally doubt that we have people who have that authority today. Well, if we do, I'm not sure how we recognize them. What's that?
You know, one of the apostolic, elements is a shepherd over a church, you know. And so my question is, well, maybe there's a house church meeting. They're meeting in a certain man's house, couple's house, and he is a shepherd over the house. Is that a legitimate?
Well, if a church is meeting in a man's house, he's the host. He might also provide some pastoral care, but he doesn't necessarily have to. It may be that church would meet in one man's house, and some other individuals who don't live in the house but who meet with them are actually providing pastoral leadership. But a pastor and an apostle are not the same thing. An apostle in the New Testament does not provide shepherding over the churches, at least in the Gentile churches. I know that the apostles in Jerusalem did provide that role in the church in Jerusalem initially, but in Paul's churches, it was not apostles, but elders who led and shepherded the churches. And there was no church that had a single guy, that is, an individual leader. Paul appointed elders, plural, in each of the churches whenever he appointed any kind of leadership. But, of course, a person could be an elder, whether someone has appointed them or not. If Christ has made them an elder, if Christ has raised them up and they're shepherding the group, or more properly, a group of elders, preferably in a group, then they are shepherds, whether they have a title or not. I'm always concerned about people who feel like they need to have titles, because titles can sometimes take the place of the reality. You know, a man can be called a pastor who's not really a shepherd at all. And a person could be shepherding who's not a pastor, doesn't call a pastor at all, but he's doing what a pastor should do. So, I mean, the reality is more important than the labels. And if you're in a house church and there literally is no one there who can take the lead, and when everyone gets together, they just sit around and twiddle their thumbs and there's nothing happening because no one leads, well, then there does seem to be, something deficient about the group. On the other hand, they don't have to have one person to be the leader. There could be three or four guys. You know, I was in a home church once in Oregon years ago for a couple of years. There were 10 families in it. And there were no official leaders because all 10 of the heads of the household were about equally qualified to be elders. It didn't make any sense to appoint anyone as an elder. We didn't need that. I mean, everyone could lead in his own way, so to speak. We didn't have a liturgy that had to be led, but if we did, any one of them could have stepped up and done that. So, I mean, you may have recognized leaders, or you might have a group that doesn't need to recognize leaders. At least initially.
I think the term that comes up more is a covering. If you go out, you know,
I've heard that.
A church covering that you go to on Sunday, and you know.
Yeah, I've heard that. I've heard that term covering. I've heard that term covering too. But one place I never heard it was in the Bible. The Bible doesn't ever mention covering in that respect. Yeah. That's entirely a human institutional thing. It's sort of like a flow chart that corporations have. You answer to this person, they answer to this person, they answer to this person. Therefore, you have a covering. No, the Bible doesn't recognize that phenomenon in the churches. That developed later on in the institutionalization of the church. It may well be that those who are spiritual leaders in the group who truly do shepherd the flock, they may be in some sense providing some kind of a spiritual covering over the group, but the Bible never uses that term, and it never suggests that a group that meets in a home has to be somehow answerable or covered by a larger group somewhere else. Those are all just institutional church traditions.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Very interesting topic. And, we have a church that we attend regularly on Sunday, and one of our members from our church has a Bible study, a weekly Bible study in his house. But there are people from other churches that attend the Bible study as well.
Uh-huh.
But, our leader, our host, leads their covering is that the church we all attend, most of us attend together.
There's nothing wrong with a large group having smaller groups within it that meet for Bible studies like that. That's fine. I mean, but if he thinks he's covered by them, I'm not really sure what he thinks they're providing for him. I think what he's trying to say is he's not rebelling against that church. He's not trying to start an offshoot group independently of that church, but he sees himself as, still connected to and having some, kinship with and relationship with that group, especially. There's a difference between a Bible study group that's a small group from a larger church, a midweek Bible group, on the one hand, and a group that meets strictly to be, to have church in a home or whatever. I mean, there's both events take place in a home, but the real question is how do they view themselves? And, there are lots of groups that meet in homes where the leader does not see himself as founding or leading a church in his home, but he's just, working in concert with a larger body under other leaders, but that's fine too. That's a different thing than having a home church. That's having a home Bible study. Yeah.
Right. Well, I won't take any more time. Thank you very much for your answer. I appreciate it.
Okay, Jim. Thanks for your call. God bless you too. All right, Phil from Antioch, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I want to ask just two little quick questions. Like I was doing a study about Matthew. Someone told me Matthew's just for the Jews only. And then I heard you just now talk about commentaries. But I study a lot of commentaries. And I read a lot of stuff on commentaries, and some people have one opinion and some people have another opinion. And your opinion, should I take any of these guys seriously? On the commentaries?
Well, when you read a commentary or when you read anything else, the thing you're interested in is the truth. Now, there's no commentator or group of commentators who are omniscient. That is, there's no man who writes a book about the Bible who knows everything and is always going to be right about everything. But that doesn't mean the people who write the commentaries don't know anything. There are people who, when you read them, you'll find true things that they're saying. They'll tell you some historical background of a passage. They'll tell you something about what the Greek words mean or what the Hebrew words mean. They'll tell you something about perhaps the setting the letter was written in. And these in many cases, most cases, would be true things. I mean, some people make that stuff up somewhat, but not many. I mean, a legitimate commentator is going to give you the truth about that. Now, when it comes to interpreting passages beyond the fact that they're telling you what the Greek words mean or whatever and what the setting was, you're going to have to sometimes use some discernment, because every commentator has a particular theological bent. Every Christian does, and commentators are usually Christians. So usually the commentator is going to have some kind of a theological bent, and he may, in his commentary, color his comments, his interpretive comments, in favor of his theological position. Now, his position might be good or not. And that's why reading commentators with different views can be helpful. But you don't read a commentator in order to let him tell you what to believe. Don't ever do that. Don't ever say, oh, I've got a commentary now. Now I can figure out what everything means. I'll just read what this commentator says. I've got, you know, I've got a Scofield Reference Bible. I've got a John MacArthur Study Bible. I've got a, you know, Ryrie Study Bible or something like that. You know, don't let those men tell you what to believe. Let them tell you what they know and what they think they know. And then you search the scriptures and see if these things are so. That's just like when you listen to a guy like me on the radio. You know, I'm giving you my understanding of things, but that may, you know, I hope I'm right, but I could be wrong. So you're going to have to search the scriptures and know whether to believe what I say or not, because I'm doing on the air right now something similar to what a commentator does in print, you know. And you can't just listen to a radio host and say, well, I like him. I think he's smart, so I'm going to just believe what he says. You should never do that. And you shouldn't do that with a writer either, a commentator or anything else. You should read the Bible. The Holy Spirit is your teacher. And teachers like myself or like commentators or others, pastors who preach or teach the Bible, you know, those people can tell you what they believe the Bible means. And you then and the Holy Spirit need to read the Bible and see if that rings true, if that's really true, or if they're getting something wrong. A lot of times people say, this verse means such and such. And you'll look at the verse and say, well, that it doesn't seem to me that it means that. And so as you look at the context and such, you may find that the pastor or the teacher or the commentator is right. Or you might find that they're wrong. So you don't delegate your thinking to a scholar. Scholars know more than you do about some things, but they don't know everything. So I would say, you know, if they tell you things that anyone could know from scholarly study, like what the Greek words mean, or what was going on in the city of Corinth at the time that the Corinthian epistles were written, or something like that, I would just say, well, good, I'm glad to have someone tell me that, because I wouldn't know that intuitively. But then when it comes to them saying, you know, and this doctrine is supported by this verse, well, then you should look at that verse and see if it's true. Does it support it? I don't know. I'm not seeing it there. Or maybe I am. So, you know, when it comes to interpreting and putting together theological or doctrinal positions from Scripture, you have to recognize every commentator has his own theological understanding. And that's okay. He can't help that. No one can help that. Everyone has their own theological understanding. But you need to realize that nobody is infallible except God. And so as you read a commentary, just realize that some of the things in it may not ring true as you compare what they're saying with what you actually see in the Bible itself. Trust the Bible itself. And but don't throw out the commentary. Just realize, okay, I'm going to take some of this. What he's saying is helpful to me. Some of it's, I just see his own fallibility here. Remember what Paul said in 1 Thessalonians 5:21. He said, prove all things and hold fast to what is good. You know, prove means test. Test everything you hear and hold fast to the parts that pass the test that are good. The other parts don't. You know, people sometimes talk about eating the meat and spitting out the bones. That's like a real famous metaphor for the same thing. That you hear what people say and you do it with discernment. Every Christian needs to develop discernment. And that discernment has to be informed from his or her own reading of the scripture. But that doesn't mean you can't learn something from people who have learned some things you haven't learned. But just don't be too gullible, or else you'll become a cult follower of some individual. That's not what you want to do. Well, we're out of time. I appreciate your calls today. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. We are a listener-supported ministry. We don't have any commercial breaks in the course of our hour. We don't sell anything at our website or on the air. We don't have any underwriters. We just depend on listeners like you to either help us pay the radio bills or not. If we don't, we go off the air. If we do, we stay on the air. It's just that simple. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can do that from our website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us, and God bless you.